This is the voice of the Trumpet Magazine. News, economy, politics, trends, discovery, health, family, the Bible, the future. This is Trumpet Hour, the week in review.
Welcome to the Trumpet's weekly review of all the important news. I'm Joel Hilliker, and with me is our panel. Here in the studio, we have Jeremiah Jacques.
Good to be with you.
And Andrew Miller.
Hello.
From our office in Britain, we have Richard Palmer.
Good afternoon.
And from our office in Jerusalem, Brent Nachtigall.
Hi.
Welcome to 2021. 2020 was pretty rough. There was so much disastrous news this past year, most of it self-inflicted, of course. A lot of people are hoping that this will be a kinder, more favorable year. But when you know the prophecies of the Bible, you know things are going to get far worse before they get better. And we shouldn't expect anything to return to what we might consider normal. We're going to start today's show with news of a significant trade agreement between two global giants, China and the European Union. To learn about this, we'll go to Jeremiah.
Yes, on Wednesday, Chinese President Xi Jinping held a video conference with German Chancellor Angela Merkel, French President Emmanuel Macron, and also European Commission President Ursula von der Leyen, and then the EU Council President was there as well. So a lot of very big names there, and they came to a major milestone in an investment agreement that had been 7 years in the making. This deal is called the Comprehensive Agreement on Investment, or the CAI. And at the end of this meeting about it, they said negotiations are now concluded in principle. So, you know, there are still some hurdles to cross, as there often are with these kinds of things, and it could still be derailed in the ratification process. But in principle, it's concluded, at least at this phase, and this is a major investment deal. The main thing it does is make it easier for European companies to operate in China. So it's also being billed as doing the reverse, making it easier for Chinese companies to operate in Europe. But in reality, Europe has always been far more open and fair than China with multinationals in the continent. So it's mostly about China agreeing to correct that imbalance and let European firms just have a more equal footing. China-EU trade has already been booming. China actually overtook the U.S. last year in 2020 and became the EU's largest trading partner. It had $590 billion worth of trade just through October. But now with this new investment deal on the table, that's set to drastically grow. But just to get into some of the details here, it used to be the case that if an EU firm wanted to operate in China, they would have to set up a joint venture with a Chinese company, and they'd have to share all kinds of sensitive technology with the Chinese in the process of that. So that was a horrible requirement, but a lot of companies did it because otherwise they wouldn't have access to the very lucrative, enormous Chinese market there. And then another detail is that this new deal is supposed to open China up to the EU's various banks. So huge for the European financial sector there. And then it's supposed to, probably most importantly, take the mask off of a lot of China's secret government subsidies. So, you know, that would make it so that European companies have fair competition instead of competing with a company that behind the scenes is getting all sorts of state-sponsored support from the Chinese Communist Party. So it would all just level the playing field quite a lot. And it doesn't cover every industry, but it does hit some big ones, including new energy vehicles, cloud computing services, health and financial services, as I mentioned a moment ago. And in the European Commission statement about this deal, it said, quote, "The negotiated result is the most ambitious outcome that China has ever agreed to." So, you know, if everything is formalized, this will just invite quite a lot more EU investment into China and bring the two sides far closer together.
So I'd like to just break this down a little bit on both sides of this deal, what this tells us about China and about the EU. Let's just start with China. If they're the ones that are basically making the concessions to enable Europeans to make these investments in China, what was it that motivated them to take these steps.
Yeah, that's, you know, that's really why this deal had stalled for 7 years, why it took so long to make. It was because the Chinese had been stalling. The Chinese have gotten very used to breaking all the rules they can to give themselves trade advantages. Mm. So they never seem terribly eager to offer the concessions to Europe that this deal requires. But right now you have the Anglo-Saxon world, especially the US, the UK, Australia, just really levying some serious criticism at China for its, you know, the handling of the coronavirus, for its atrocious human rights, for its crackdown on Hong Kong. The list goes on and on. So China is feeling a little isolated by some powerful countries, and Xi Jinping was suddenly more willing to at least say that he would make these concessions. And then there's also a huge, you know, aspect of this with Xi Jinping expecting Mr. Biden to become the president in the United States. And she expects Biden to really reverse course on some of the measures that President Trump had taken against Europe. So, you know, just this week, the Trump administration stepped up its trade dispute with Europe over aircraft subsidies. And then the Trump administration ended up increasing tariffs on European aircraft parts and some other products from Europe. So Xi Jinping thinks that a Biden presidency will mean the end of some of that kind of, you know, wrangling between the U.S. and the EU, and a big thaw between the U.S. and the EU. She also thinks that a Biden presidency could actually mean a united Western front against China that would make China genuinely accept a liberal and kind of a rules-based international economic model. So Xi Jinping, of course, didn't want any of that, and he seemed to want to move quickly on this China-EU deal to make it happen before a Biden presidency could come about and begin to move Europe closer to the U.S. So this, I think, was Xi Jinping making a preemptive play against that, and it has been viewed as a big victory for him.
Well, it certainly is interesting to see this happening, the timing of this taking place in this period where it appears there will be a Joe Biden presidency. And you have this kind of jockeying for how to position themselves in light of that eventuality. I think there's just a whole lot of things that are being revealed because of the way that this is playing out on the political scene within the United States. Another interesting aspect of this is the fact that it really has been just in the last few months that the pressure on China exposing so many of their activities, you mentioned a few of them, the handling of the virus and some of the internal activities within China that are violating human rights, the way that they're treating Australia, all of this is being exposed and kind of a spotlight put on this. And it's despite all of that, that Europe is saying we're totally fine with opening up this trade relationship with China.
Yeah, I think that's a huge aspect of this. And this is a shameful deal for Europe to be making for that reason. You know, Europe champions itself as an advocate of human rights and as a defender of international labor standards. And they know very well that the Chinese economy is run largely on the back of slave labor. You know, in the Xinjiang region, China has over 1 million members of the Muslim Uyghur minority detained, and many of them provide forced labor all over the country. They bus them around to, you know, work in all sorts of factories. China also uses many kinds of less egregious forced labor practices, and it has never accepted that it's even doing anything wrong with all of that. And the Europeans know that, but still Europe entered into this deal that really signs off on China's abuses of all those people. And Europe will even end up profiting as a result of that. 2020 was, as you said, just a chilling year for China, not just with the Uyghur Muslims, but also with its crackdown on Hong Kong back in right. June and July, especially. Its bullying in the Taiwan Strait and the South China Sea really ramped up. Even its wolf warrior diplomacy right there in Europe. And Australia also, as you mentioned there, the kind of the mask came off of how horrible China has been treating Australia for a number of years. These are all just huge red flags. And people like Merkel and Macron should understand that this is just kind of a deal with the devil that they're entering into. But instead, they seem to care more about sliding the U.S. however they can. Hmm. So it's I think it's just a sad commentary on Europe's priorities.
Right, and their own economic benefit,
exactly.
At whomever may hurt from that. So just to look at this more from the European angle, I'd like to bring Richard in on this. We talked about what was motivating China to make sure that this deal was done before, say, a presidential inauguration in the United States. What's your view on why Europe was eager to get this done so quickly?
I can answer that in one word. Germany. This is a deal that was just really driven forwards by Germany. They co-opted France a bit in pushing this through. But you know, China is the Europe's largest trade partner, but really so much of that trade is coming from Germany. You know, if you're talking about this is an investment deal, it's about making it easier for European companies to work in China, to invest in China. That's really German companies. Those are the ones, you know, it's German luxury car makers that are going and setting up shop over there and things like that. And so this is something that they're driving half a trillion euros in trade between the EU and China. And it's been really interesting to see for Germany to be in that driving seat. And it's caused a lot of discontent in Europe. I think it shows that Germany is the one really driving the break with America that Jeremiah talked about. You know, the New York Times wrote that Europeans' decision to overlook objections from the Biden camp was an indication that relations with the United States will not automatically snap back to the relative bonhomie that prevailed during the Obama administration. So it's Germany the ones declaring they want a big break, Germany the ones declaring that they want this trade deal.
Surely there are a lot of Europeans saying, why are we doing this? This is very contrary to our principles.
That's right. There's a number of different objections. I mean, you've got Poland, for example, that would like to have a close relationship with the United States. They see this deal in the very much in the geopolitical terms that Jeremiah set out. This is aligning Europe more with China, and they don't want that. And there are other nations within the European Union that don't want that. They would rather be closely aligned to the United States. And then you've got other countries like Italy, Belgium, Spain. They don't stand to gain much from this deal. And as Jeremiah pointed out, it has some of these major, major ethical problems. It really exposes Europe's hypocrisy. And for them, I don't think they're necessarily any more moral than Germany is, but you know, it's engaging and exposing that hypocrisy with no real benefit for them. So their response is kind of, you know, why are we doing this? And so there's a lot of dissatisfaction now. You're having officials from all of these countries criticizing the way that Germany is pushing this through. They pushed it through in the very final days of Germany's presidency of the Council of Europe. But you know, all along the way, you've got a lot of Germans with their hands on the levers of power. Politico wrote that EU officials say that they felt steamrolled by Merkel and the German engine. Just pointing out that you have, you know, Angela Merkel as the European Commission president, Ursula von der Leyen as leading president of the European Commission, Trade Department Director Sabine Weyand, you know, Germans at all of these different levels. One EU diplomat said there's a lot of frustration among smaller companies about the way the Commission has been used to push through one of Merkel's pet projects at the end of her term and at the end of her legacy. You know, this is one of the big things she wanted to bring about, this realignment. They quoted the same diplomat saying, is this the way the EU will work post-Brexit? The Brits are just out and we're already missing their open market orientated approach, which I think is a really interesting question.
Mm-hmm.
Britain is just out of the European Union. Is this the way it is now, that Germany just steamrolls everyone else? If Germany wants something and nobody else really does, Germany gets it. You know, we're starting to miss Britain already, actually, because you know, Britain would have thrown up some pretty major roadblocks, I think, to this deal. I mean, we've had our own past of trying to court the Chinese as well. But
this is one of the objections to Brexit. People were saying it's better for us to be on the inside to try to prevent exactly this type of thing from happening.
Yeah, and you can see how Brexit is now giving Europe an opportunity to move much further forwards and giving Germany more power. Really, that now that they're left as one of the fewer big beasts inside this slightly smaller European Union.
Yeah. Well, that does bring us to how this factors into prophecy. Maybe we can just return to Jeremiah for a moment here. Economic cooperation between Asia and Europe this is something that we've been talking about for quite some time because of a specific prophecy that Isaiah wrote.
That's right. Yes, the prophet Isaiah wrote about this more than 2,500 years ago. And in Isaiah 23, he discusses this immensely powerful multinational trade alliance that would develop in the modern age. And he actually tells who the main players in this bloc would be. He says Chittim is one of them. And Trumpet editor-in-chief Gerald Fleury has written in his book, Isaiah's End Time Vision, that Chittim is an ancient name that indicates modern China. And then another of the big players that Isaiah mentions is Tyre. And Mr. Fleury explains that that's an ancient name for modern Europe, especially in an economic sense. So the scriptures go on there and they show that Russia and Japan would also join this bloc. And together, these nations will actually come to control global trade just for a brief time. But they'll use that control to actually strangle America and some of its allies. I'll just read a quote from Mr. Fleury's book, Isaiah's End Time Vision. He says, "The Bible contains many prophecies of a European power attacking America. When it happens, there will be no help or sympathy from Asia. In fact, Russia, China, and Japan will form a brief alliance with Europe. All of them are going to besiege America, Britain, and the Jewish nation. This is why Isaiah's prophecy of an end-time mart of nations that includes both European and Asian powers is so intriguing, and why the trend of collusion between these two great economic blocs is worth watching." Mm-hmm. So, very powerful analysis there that basically describes exactly what we're seeing with this new investment deal and just with the surging trade between China and Europe. And I think that we should not be surprised to see Europe willing to ignore China's terrible human rights abuses and its illegal trade practices. In light of all these prophecies, we should actually expect the ties now growing between the EU and China to just keep on growing stronger. And even as China grows more aggressive and malicious, we should expect Europe to increasingly side with China and against America.
Mm-hmm. And just to return to the Germany point, this is also really exactly what we expect within Europe. And we've seen just how much Germany has grown in political power, in economic power. This is more evidence of that. And even looking at this from a standpoint of the what Europe looks like after Britain leaves, Germany is more powerful. This, too, is exactly according to prophecy.
That's right. This time last year, the cover article of the Trumpet print was an article from our editor-in-chief, "Is KT Zu Gutenberg About to Come to Power?" Which was talking about, basically this article is all about how we're expecting a strong leader to come from Germany and lead all of Europe. This is what we began the year with in 2020. It's something that we're very much looking and watching for in 2021 as well. And so that would be a great place to go to understand this prophecy of how Europe is going to have a strong leader. And you can already see Germany growing in power. And so, you know, this is under Angela Merkel. Angela Merkel isn't particularly known for steamrolling people. And Germany is still able to pull this kind of thing off. How much is Germany's power within Europe and around the world just going to increase when they have a strong leader in there?
All right, great stuff. Thank you both, Jeremiah and Richard. Tensions between the United States and Iran are heating up. Some say Iran is preparing for an attack. To learn about this, we'll turn to Brent Noctegal.
This is something that we have been reporting on for a couple of weeks, just the heightened tensions between the United States and Iran, as Iran believes that President Trump is on his way out. And we have the big anniversary coming up here on January 3rd, the one-year anniversary of the assassination by the Trump administration of Qasem Soleimani, the head of Iran's Quds Force, basically the head of Iran's forces that worked outside the country, in charge of all the other terrorist proxies that you hear of, Hezbollah in Lebanon and the Shiite militias in Iraq, the Houthis. It was Qasem Soleimani who was Iran's leadership over those groups. And he was killed, of course, back in January 3rd last year. And so the expectation is, and the rhetoric coming from Iran is, that Iran has not fully gotten back at the United States for that attack. The Ayatollah said that they've given the United States a slap on the face. for that. And yet over the past 2 weeks, the Ayatollah has said that Iran has not fully well, there is some greater retribution coming. Even Rouhani, the president, said this past week that there's more coming. He even threatened the life of President Donald Trump, saying that his life will be over soon. And so there is the worry that this next week could be incredibly dangerous in the Middle East. In light of that, you had McKenzie, General McKenzie, who's the highest level of the U.S. Central Command. He authorized the flying of B-52 bombers on Wednesday over the region as a deterring effort against Iran. And then we also had last week the announcement that the USS Georgia, a guided missile submarine, has made its way to the Persian Gulf as well. And in his statement, he said this was a deterring effort to stop aggressors from thinking that they could attack the United States. So there is you also had Javad Zarif, actually, who's the foreign minister of Iran. He came out and said that President Trump is trying to create a pretext for war, which indicates that there is some type of Iranian action that's going to take place very soon, perhaps this week coming.
So America is bracing for something. Are they focusing on particular targets that Iran may focus on?
Well, there was a rocket attack again back on December 20th against the United States Embassy inside Baghdad. We reported, I think, at the time that there was 8 rockets that were fired. There were, in fact, 21, and 9 of those actually landed on the inside the embassy compound. So this is some, and one person was killed, but just wasn't American. This was a heavy attack in Iraq by Shiite militias that answer to Iran. And so this was a sign, the United States is taking that as a sign that they expect if there is going to be an attack by Iran, it will be inside Iraq, and it will be, because again, Iraq is where Soleimani was killed at the Baghdad airport. And so they expect one of these militia groups to start attacking U.S. forces or U.S. assets, probably the embassy inside Iraq. Now, it's also interesting that Israel just released a statement from its an official of the Northern Command that they expect Hezbollah to actually launch an attack fairly soon. And this is an attack that would take a couple of days to actually deal with, which is something Israel has not seen from the North since the Second Lebanon War. And so there is growing expectation that these next couple of weeks could be quite dangerous in the region.
Donald Trump he's been much tougher on Iran than Joe Biden has been and promises to be. And you could see some of what Iran is doing here as response to their belief that Joe Biden is going to be America's president. Nevertheless, even Donald Trump has been doing his level best to withdraw America from Iraq. And it seems like any bloody nose that we may get in that country is just all the more evidence that we need to get out of there.
Yeah, this week I listened to an interview with Michael Pregent, who was an intelligence officer that worked with the Iraqi government and the United States. He's a U.S. officer for a number of years back during the Iraq War, and he is heavily committed to the Iraqi field. Knows a lot of the players. And this is the first time I heard him say that it might be time for the United States to recognize that the Baghdad government is beyond saving, that it is so far in Iran's back pocket that it cannot go forward thinking that it has a friend or an ally with the Baghdad government. And so that it's probably time right now to get out of that country. And it's going to be on the backs of the Iraqi citizens to try and throw off the Iranian hold. Now, coming from him, it was something that was really powerful, because this is something, obviously, that Mr. Gerald Flurry has prophesied for the past 30 years, that Iran would run the United States out of Iraq. Yeah. And given that the Iraqi government is unwilling to stop Iran's militias that operate inside Iraq from firing on U.S. assets, and U.S. buildings and U.S. forces, as they may do this coming week, it's going to be a sign to President Trump that it is, in fact, time to get out. If people want to read more about this prophecy and the longstanding forecast of what Iran is going to do in the Middle East and how they will take over Iraq, our editor-in-chief's book, The King of the South, is the place to go.
Oh, thanks very much for that, Brent. This coming week is a big one for America, with more milestones and progress toward the presidential inauguration. Evidence undermining the legitimacy of the Joe Biden victory in the election continues to mount. For this story, we'll turn to Andrew Miller.
Yeah, President Trump is gearing up for this Wednesday, January 6, when members of the House of Representatives and the Senate are planning to contest the certification of the Electoral College vote. So they'll have some big stories coming our way soon on that regard. But in the meantime, like you mentioned, there's a lot of whistleblowers and testimony coming forward of just the various ways that Democrats used to steal this election. I think one of the most interesting ones I've seen in the past week is an interview. It was an interview given on December 21st with the New American Magazine by former NSA senior analyst Kirk Wiebe. And I don't know if maybe some of our listeners have heard of him. He was a senior analyst for the NSA for years, from 1975 to 2001, was awarded the Meritorious Civilian Service Award, which is the NSA's second highest reward, did a lot of computer work for the NSA, designing programs to track terrorists around the world. So pretty big name. And even bigger name, because he hasn't worked in the NSA for a while. He resigned after the 9/11 attacks in 2001, when he came across an illegal surveillance program to survey American citizens. And so he went public with this and resigned from the NSA, along with two of his colleagues, William Biney and Ed Loomis. And was kind of hailed as a hero by the liberal media at the time for exposing how the Bush administration and the Republicans were spying on Americans, although they quickly forgot about him and swept him under the rug when the Obama administration came along and took those same spying programs and magnified them 10 times greater than they were before. But now he's coming out with the New American Magazine and basically saying that he's seen evidence that some of these software programs he's very familiar with look like they were used in the United States presidential elections. In particular, he drew attention to a CIA supercomputer called the Hammer and a CIA software program called Scorecard that, according to him, the CIA was using to rig elections primarily in the Middle East. It's like if an anti-American terrorist is going to win an election, and I don't know, he didn't say which nation, but Yemen or someplace like that, when they send the vote tally electronically to whatever central government authority, this program can intercept the electronic communication at that point and shift a certain number of votes to the candidate desired. But he also mentioned that he has friends who have like the Hammer on their computer. Like former NSA employees. So he said the security for it wasn't great. He said, I know there's people outside the NSA who aren't even working for the NSA right now who have this software. And said when you're looking at some of the statistical anomalies in the election, like the way the percentages fall, he said it really looks like this leaked software was used in our own country. And that's not something he's just made up after the fact. He went, it was back in March of this year, well before the election. Him and William Biney went to Congress with a thumb drive with 85,000 documents on it, warning them that it's like, hey, this software is at large, and it could be used in this elections. The state attorney generals need to take whatever precautions needed. And then he goes on in this interview saying that said that the state attorney generals really did absolutely nothing about that warning.
The future of the American Republic is on the line, and it's remarkable how little interest all of these officials have in defending that.
Right. You'd think there'd be a huge investigation because, I mean, like I said, this is like William Biney, Kurt Loomis, Ed Loomis. Yeah, these are like high-ranking NSA people. And then they have a few other General Michael Flynn has made similar comments. General Thomas McHenry has made similar comments. Yeah, that one Air Force General, General Thomas McHenry, and he wasn't as involved in the development of these software programs as some of the NSA guys were. But he's actually gone public saying that the Obama administration has used this software in past elections. They said there's evidence that they used it in Florida to steal the election from Mitt Romney in 2012. And I guess you can believe that or you cannot believe that. I just happen to just his word to go on right now. But I mean, he was a highly decorated Vietnam War pilot, 400 missions, a lieutenant general in the Air Force. So he's not just some nobody making claims with no relevant experience. Mm-hmm. But like I said, if that's true, I mean, that'd be the biggest scandal in American history that you have the Obama administration coming in and winning this landslide victory in 2008 and then using the power of these intelligence agencies you've inherited to keep your administration in power after that. There's definitely, I mean, many types of election fraud you're looking at in this election. But if those are true, then like I said, you're not living in a democratic republic anymore. There's an illusion mm-hmm. that you're voting for your leaders. But if you can use a software program like this or even old fashioned ballot stuffing, it's like they hold votes in Iran and they hold votes in communist right. China. It's an open joke.
Yeah.
But it's
You know, our editor in chief, Gerald Fleury, he said recently that he feels like there are so many Republicans that don't even realize that we're in a war. They keep acting like this is all just going to go away. That okay, we lost this time. Aw shucks, you know, let's try again in 4 years, and we can keep kind of working with these Democrats and trying to be collegial and friendly and so on. They're in a war. They're losing a war. They're losing badly. And the opposition is putting themselves in a position to never, ever lose again. And it seems there's just so little interest in trying to do something about that and take the fight to the enemy. The will has been broken. It really is remarkable to see that take place. Well, Andrew has written an article that is up on the website or will be up there soon. NSA whistleblower Kirk Wiebe exposes U.S. stolen election. And as he brings out the prophecy that we have heard from our editor-in-chief about what is actually going to happen here, Donald Trump will remain America's president, is one that you have to really keep your eye on. These coming days and weeks should be quite exciting. Just buckle your seatbelts and watch how this unfolds. And as Gerald Fleury said, we can expect fraud to be exposed on a scale like never before seen in this country. Thanks for that, Andrew. You're listening to Trumpet Hour. Coming up, how Vladimir Putin continues to tighten his control over Russia, news about Gibraltar, politics in the Jewish state of Israel, and America's newest massive stimulus spend. We'll be right back.
This is the voice of the Trumpet News Magazine. You're listening to Trumpet Hour.
Vladimir Putin became significantly stronger as leader of Russia over this past year, and he capped off the year with some final touches, cementing his grip on power. For this story, we'll go back to Jeremiah Jacques.
Yes, Putin ended 2020 by signing off on a set of laws that gives the Russian government new powers to label people or organizations as foreign agents if they engage in certain political activity. And what's worrying is that Russia's legal definition of political activity is extremely broad. This can basically be applied to anyone who offers any sort of negative opinion on a Russian government policy. So even if the person is offering that opinion in a Facebook post or in a tweet, you know, if you tweet something critical of the Russian government, you could be labeled as a foreign agent and find yourself in violation of this law and possibly be imprisoned for it. Or if you participate in a political protest, that would be enough to run afoul of this legislation. So we have seen these kinds of laws in Russia before, but this time it gives the authorities the power to wield it against pretty much any voice of dissent. And it does show that Putin is just tightening his grip on the Russian people.
So put this in the context of what else he's done this year to make sure that he remains in power indefinitely.
Yeah, 2020 really was a very good year for Putin. Inside of Russia, you know, he just passed these laws that we mentioned. He also sent a blaring message to his domestic enemies by having his most prominent opposition figure poisoned, and poisoned with a substance that would show that Putin's fingerprints were on it. Then Putin also signed legislation in 2020 that protects former presidents from prosecution. And then another law that lets former presidents become senators for life if they leave the presidency. Those would both be huge for him if he were to leave office. But it looks like Putin won't need to use either of those because he also pushed a constitutional amendment through that will let him remain president of Russia basically for life. So, you know, that was inside of Russia. But then outside of Russia, he also strengthened you know, his position. With the former Soviet states, we saw him throw a lifeline to the Belarusian president. We saw him bring Uzbekistan close to being a member of the Eurasian Economic Union. We saw him broker a huge peace deal between Armenia and Azerbaijan. With that last one, he was actually able to place Russian forces in Azerbaijan for the first time, so a huge victory there. He also militarized the Arctic to a great degree. In 2020, he clinched an agreement that gives Russia a port in Sudan. All the while, he continued to build up Russia's military power, making it more capable than at any time since the end of the Cold War. So it all does just show that Putin concluded 2020 significantly stronger than he started it.
Where would you send people to explain why this is important prophetically?
I would send them to Trumpet Editor-in-Chief Gerald Fleury's booklet. It's called The Prophesied Prince of Russia, and it shows that Putin actually, we should expect him just to keep on growing stronger inside of Russia and also in its periphery with the former Soviet states and beyond. And it places it all in the context of Bible prophecy.
All right. Thank you, Jeremiah. Gibraltar is one of the most important sea gates in the world. It's been under British control for over 300 years, but Britain's exit from the European Union has raised questions about this territory. It's right there in the corner of Spain. For this story, we'll go back to Richard Palmer.
Yes, so at midnight tonight, we left the European Union. We talked last week about this withdrawal agreement that had been signed, or this trade agreement, setting out Britain's relationship with the European Union. Well, just in the closing days of our, before we got fully out of there, the UK also signed a deal with Spain, a separate deal dealing with the territory of Gibraltar. And the upshot of this deal is that Gibraltar will kind of stay with Europe as we move abroad. Now, they're still, you know, we haven't handed over official sovereignty or control, but we have handed over a lot. So Gibraltar has several thousand people that travel across the border to work in Spain. And that's Gibraltar's not a huge place. So those workers that cross the border, that's a pretty big deal for Gibraltar's economy. It would be absolutely catastrophic for their whole economy, for everything, if then suddenly that border was closed. People had all of those thousands of people that crossed to go to work every day, crossed to come back again, had to show border identification as they were now crossing a hard border. So you can understand why they were negotiating on a border here, why they were trying to come up with some kind of deal. So under this deal, though, Gibraltar is now set to become part of the Schengen zone, which You know, this is the free travel area within Europe that even quite a few EU members are not part of, where you can travel. You know, this is the deal that allows you to travel from France into Belgium, into the Netherlands, into Germany without having to get your passport out, without having to stop for border controls. Gibraltar is going to be part of that zone. And in order to enable that, well, that means that Spain is ultimately going to be responsible for border checks at Gibraltar's ports, at Gibraltar's airport. So if you're flying from London to Gibraltar, yes, you're flying from one part of the UK to another part that's at least ruled by the UK. But it looks like you're going to have to show your passport and go through some kind of customs and immigration controlled by the Spanish or by the European by Frontex, the European Border Force, and they're going to be playing a role there as well. So, sure, on paper, Gibraltar is still part of or ruled by the UK, but that's a whole lot of power that we're giving Spain, and that is a very big step towards Spanish control. And you could easily see this being the moment in future. When people looking back say, well, this is when Gibraltar started to go away from Europe or away from the UK and towards Europe.
If you wouldn't mind, explain why what we've said about that and Britain's loss of Gibraltar, how there's a certain inevitability to that.
Right. This is exactly what we've been forecasting, that in his book, The United States and Britain in Prophecy, Herbert W. Armstrong talked about how God gave various sea gates to Britain and America. And there are all these scriptures in the Bible that talk about, it talks about gates in the Bible, Britain and America, or the descendants of modern Israel being given the gates of their enemies. I mean, when you're talking about nations, what is a gate? You know, often it's a sea gate or something like that that provides, allows you to close the door on a lot of trade or military movement, that kind of thing. And he was writing that book. This was one of the material for that book was one of the first things that he was working on all the way back, I think, the 20s and the 30s. I can't remember when exactly it first appeared in print. But he made a very specific prediction in that book, something very measurable, something very testable, where he said, well, Britain and America are going to lose control of their sea gates. And writing that, you know, decades and decades ago, that would have definitely seemed a tall order. And we have our own booklet. It's called He Was Right. There's a chapter in that called Changing of the Guard that just goes through and catalogs how many of those specifics we've already seen. Jeremiah talks regularly on this show about Hong Kong and the sea gate that Britain has given up there. That's an excellent example of this fulfilled prophecy. Now you can see Gibraltar heading in that direction. So that article, that chapter, Changing of the Guard from He Was Right, will help explain what the Bible says about this and how so much of this prophecy has already been fulfilled.
All right, very good. Thank you very much for that, Richard. Israeli politics remain in limbo with an upcoming election and investigations against the prime minister continuing. For an update on the latest developments, we'll go back to Brent Noctegal.
Yes, elections again are set for the end of March 2021, which is going to come very fast. The latest poll out today from the Jerusalem Post had Benny Gantz's party, the Blue and White, who were in coalition with Prime Minister Netanyahu's Likud party, actually not making the electoral threshold, meaning that party would no longer be part of the Knesset, which shows you how quickly things can change in Israeli politics if your name is not Benjamin Netanyahu, who has been in power for 12 years going on 13. So that's something to look forward to. It changes as different political parties get announced every second day. The mayor of Tel Aviv announced a new center-left party. They have to put center in there just to make it appeal to some people, but it's probably a very far left-wing party. And of course, you have New Hope led by the former Netanyahu, or former Likud Knesset member Gideon Saar, which is now the second largest party, would be the second largest party inside the Knesset had elections held today. So it looks like there's going to be no huge change in the shape of Israel's Knesset in terms of conservative versus left or right versus left. However, there is jostling among the right-wing parties to try and still try and play their hand at removing Netanyahu from power as well. Now, there was something on the side of that that took place this week, which I found incredibly interesting. This has to do with the ongoing investigations against, well, not just investigations, the court case against Prime Minister Netanyahu. He's been charged with three different cases of fraud, breach of trust, and bribery. And we've reported on these over the past year or so. This case is being heard right now at a Jerusalem district court. It's not at the Supreme Court just yet. Of course, if Netanyahu fails to pass that test, it's likely that he is going to try and appeal that decision. However, the district court today, at the request of Netanyahu's lawyers, asked the prosecution, so this is the state prosecution that's trying to bring down Netanyahu, they asked them to produce written authorization of the initial investigations against the prime minister. According to Israel's basic law, which is kind of like their constitution, they don't have one, but it's the strongest thing they have, an investigation against a sitting prime minister cannot start unless the attorney general has signed off on it. And it turns out that the Netanyahu's lawyers believe that the attorney general did not sign off on it before it began. So it had some roots earlier than going through the official channels of how it should begin. And so the district court has given the prosecution 1 week to present evidence of when that written authority was given to the police to start investigating a sitting prime minister. And they're yet to bring it forward, or at least it hasn't come forward yet.
This is a fascinating story. You have an article up on thetrumpet.com today explaining the timing of all of this relative to, I guess, similar events going on within the United States in what has been called the deep state, these individuals working at a very high level and trying to enact policies to undermine, in the case of America, an incoming government, in this case, a sitting government. There's a whole lot of people that want to bring Benjamin Netanyahu down. And maybe you could just describe the evidence that this is exactly what we're seeing here. It's kind of a parallel situation to what happened in the United States.
Well, I think if we don't even go into looking at the charges that are against him, because they are reminiscent of the charges that I would say the closest thing you would have had was how the United States Congress tried to impeach the president on these made-up claims, fabricated claims. The type of charges against Netanyahu accepting some type of gifts from foreign governments and then trying to get favorable coverage from the media that they're so out there that a lot of people can see that they're trumped up charges that aren't going to be something that that shouldn't hold in court. However, what's interesting, and as I bring out in this article, is that these investigations started at least verbally. There were great gatherings with the attorney general and the police investigators around the same time that President Trump was about to be inaugurated. We in the U.S., you had that famous January 5th meeting between President Obama and Comey, Joe Biden, a number of others, and they sought to find a way to bring down one of the key elements in Trump's team, that being General Michael Flynn. That was on January 5th, and what I find interesting is that in the process of this, of the prosecutors responding to the court this week, they said that they had unofficial meetings to get approval to investigate the president and the prime minister over here. And it's interesting that one of those meetings took place on January 5th, 2017. So on the same day that you had in the United States one outgoing government planning a way of using the state apparatus to take down or hinder the next incoming administration, and that of Donald Trump, you had Israelis, the police, and the attorney general gathering to find ways, again, to bring down the Prime Minister, Benjamin Netanyahu. And as I bring out in this article, this is interesting and it is significant because there is an effort currently and ongoing, continuing to really focus on destroying the United States, destroying even the state of Israel because of their biblical history and who they are in biblical prophecy as well. They make up the modern states. They're part of the modern states of the ancient nation of Israel. And so when we see these these separate meetings taking place on the same day, and their efforts to undermine a leader that believes in the history and the biblical history, let's say in Israel's case, and then in the United States, that believes in the fundamental right of the United States to govern itself by the Constitution of the United States in terms of Donald Trump. When you see both of those men being attacked in the same way, there is a spiritual connection that should be noticed. And for an article that could help people understand that spiritual connection to the attempt to bring down Donald Trump and Netanyahu, Mr. Gerald Flurry's article, The Barack Obama Mystery, really will do well to explain that.
That and the article that Brent wrote, the title of that, Are the Unlawful Roots of the Netanyahu Witch Hunt About to Be Exposed? That's up at thetrumpet.com right now. Thank you very much, Brent. Well, to finish, this week the U.S. passed yet another massive coronavirus relief spending bill. To learn about this, we will turn to Andrew Miller.
Yeah, after weeks of political wrangling, it looks like the U.S. government finally has its fifth COVID-19 stimulus package. The Democrats originally wanted a $3 trillion stimulus package in addition to the $2.4 trillion they spent earlier this year. The Republicans were able to negotiate them down to a $900 billion stimulus package, which would give $600 to every American adult, plus millions and millions and millions of dollars in foreign aid and gender reassignment surgeries in Pakistan right. And all sorts of other just weird pork. And so they finally got that bill ready to sign, and then President Trump came along and said $600 isn't enough for the American people. He wanted $2,000 for the American people and get rid of the pork, which probably would have been better than their original deal, although Nancy Pelosi, being the shrewd politician that she is, immediately publicly declared that she supported President Trump's proposal against the Republican Senate, knowing full well she was never going to present the Senate with a bill with no pork in it. And so I guess long story short is like Trump finally did sign the $900 stimulus package with the pork and all, giving the $600 to the American citizens. And then they came in afterwards and put an addendum upping that to $2,000 per American citizen. So we now have a full, I think it's a almost $1.4 trillion stimulus package to go up with our $2.4 from last year. I guess in the show notes we can put our infographic from the January print edition, Economic Virus, that just puts the stimulus and historic perspective, showing how this is basically the most expensive thing the federal government's done since World War II. And with this new stimulus package, I did check the numbers this morning, and it's still the COVID-19 pandemic isn't more expensive than World War II, but it's getting awfully close. If they pass a sixth one, they might just make it. But
it's remarkable that infographic, which is outstanding, and everyone needs to look at that, and it's truly shocking, it's already out of date.
Yes, it is. it had a good month run of it, but it's...
They managed to surpass even the exorbitant spending that we had documented in it.
Right, yeah, and I mean, that does make the point in that infographic that now people are talking like you just can't have too much stimulus. But I mean, this is the debt to GDP ratio jumped from 106%. The debt was 106% of America's GDP to 136% last year. Biggest jump ever. And we're well set to equal or exceed that jump this year, depending on what other stimulus packages await us in 2021.
All right. Well, thank you very much for that, Andrew. I'm Joel Hilliker, and that'll do it for today's Trumpet Hour. Email us your thoughts on the program to letters@thetrumpet.com. Thanks to our panel, Jeremiah Jacques, Andrew Miller, Richard Palmer, and Brent Noctegal. And thanks to Jeremiah for engineering and production. I'll leave you with the words of John Randolph. Time is at once the most valuable and the most perishable of all our possessions. Thanks for joining us on Trumpet Hour. Until next time, keep watching your world.
Listening to Trumpet Hour on Trumpet Radio, 101.3 KPCG, and online at kpcg.fm. Understand your world.